somewhere in the vicinity of misery, acceptance, and hope. We're exploring a new memoir about retreating during the frigid months, retreating even from the depths of COVID and finding how to cope in our own personal darkness, whatever it looks like. Let's make some space for a book conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How have you invited the winter into your life? Do you do a polar plunge ritual each year at a Wisconsin lake? What is that like to hit icy cold water? It's 800-642-1234. Catherine May is the author of fiction and nonfiction books. She lives by the sea in Whitstable, England, where she appreciates sea swimming, as we'll learn about, and long walks. Her new book is called Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Catherine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the pandemic has really made feelings of loneliness and hopelessness and loss just amplified all around us. How has the past year changed you as a writer and as a person?
Oh, well, as a writer, it's made it very hard to write indeed, actually. It's, you know, I know loads of creative people who've been watching this year and thinking, what on earth do we say about it? It's such a moment of immense change. And so much suffering that we're witnessing, and you know, so many personal fears as well. I think it's been very hard to say anything meaningful this year. And I'm really interested in what I'll find to say about it once the crisis is over, actually. That still feels all very much in the air for me. I don't know what the take home will be for this.
Do you think it's changed the way we view isolation, the way we view pain in our society, in our culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's brought everybody in this society into close contact with what maybe only a few people at a time were experiencing before. You know, there's always been lots of people in our society who are so isolated, you know, people with chronic illness, for example, people who are caring for, you know, very dependent relatives. And we've often ignored those people. They've often felt doubly isolated because they're not part of our mainstream culture. And it's really interesting, isn't it, that we now all know exactly how it feels to be so stuck and so limited and to feel like there's nothing, there's no hope coming. That's exactly what we're learning this year, I think.
Yeah, there's wintering all around us. And I want to focus now on this word and the title of your book. To me, it's like this really distant opposite cousin of winterizing, which is something I go through, putting, you know, snow tires on the car, putting weather stripping around the windows, making sure the kids have all their snow gear that fits. And, you know, really winterizing is keeping the cold out. And it's a really rigid to-do list to me. How are you letting the cold into your life in this other word, wintering?
So, I mean, I first of all have to confess that I live in a very temperate part of the UK relative to where you live. You know, I'm a bit envious of your winter storms you've got coming at the moment. I really am.
Like, I knew you would hear that in the newscast and be like, oh, that's so perfect. And
I hear it with a certain amount of yearning, I must admit. And I know you guys are probably really, you know, weary about it and thinking, oh, no, what's this going to be like? Whereas I'm like, no.
we're checking our watches and we're saying, yeah, it's about right time.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, where I live in the UK, it would be eccentric to winterize my house. It really would. But I do know that, you know, I have friends who've lived, you know, around where you live, and the enormous preparations that take place are really cumbersome, but they're also very urgent, aren't they? You know, they have to be done, or else there's terrible things that are going to happen midwinter when you can, you know, when you need to deal with it the least. But preparing for wintering, I think, is a slightly different matter, although they are related. And one of the fundamental things about it is accepting that wintering will come. It's not going to come as regularly as the season of winter. You know, it's not quite as predictable. But part of the work of being a human, I think, is that we learn to accept that actually life is never like one progressive line upwards, that if we get everything right, if we line up our ducks properly, we'll never hit a low point. That's just not how it works. We're not in control of that, actually, which I think is exactly what this pandemic has shown us. So the best way to prepare for a personal wintering is to accept that it will come. And that changes your mindset in the good times too. Not to take the edge off them, but to know that we always need to have something left in the tank in case a crisis comes.
We're talking with Catherine May, who is the author of Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times, and exploring the word wintering and what it means in our own lives and what it means collectively amid the pandemic. Share your thoughts on wintering and what you're going through at 800-642-1234. Catherine, your wintering, what I appreciate, it really has space to just be, to let feelings come as they may, and to not live like so many moms in the pandemic who are like living now where every second is just charted out, has to be really specific and really deliberate, because we may fail someone or something if every single minute isn't structured. What do you say about that?
Yeah, what can we say about that? I've been living through that this year too. I think it's interesting to me because, you know, in the course of writing the book, as I wrote about, my son dropped out of school and we had to pull him out. He was six and he'd become so anxious that he just couldn't cope with going to school anymore. So we had this kind of completely unplanned moment of homeschooling a couple of years before the rest of the world did it. It's one of the many parts of the book that has huge parallels with this year. So, I've maybe been through all of this before. And one of the things I learned during that time was to take the pressure off, that actually there is nothing that makes it worthwhile to make yourself unhappy over or to put yourselves under so much pressure, you know, you and your children, that you just don't feel you can go on, that all of life feels miserable. And I think I would urge people who are feeling that pressure and who know that it's ongoing, it's going to roll into the new year, and there's that sense of, you know, heaviness and dread, that I would urge people to allow themselves to make space in that for you and your child, just to be and just to exist and just to have relaxed time together too, because it's all too much.
It's those times that you'll remember most.
It really is. And there's so much learning in those times. I think we have to trust that children are kind of oriented towards learning. Whatever you do with them, they learn something from it. And if we're not careful, what we can teach them in times like this is how to be stressed all the time. You know, how to live a life that's under pressure, that's fearful, that is guided by kind of these very distant goals and threats of a future life without a job or whatever. And it's actually, you know, sometimes when we step back, we can get a bit more perspective on it and realize that children can learn such valuable things when it doesn't look like you're doing much, when you're not doing anything that you'd find in a textbook or in a school lesson plan. And I know that some of the best times I had when I was homeschooling my son, and believe me, I was really happy to give him back to school after a year, but were those open-ended times, you know, when we just went to the woods for the day, and I'd have planned to, you know, learn about how to identify a tree from its bark, because I love that kind of thing. And my son would have totally other ideas, you know, we'd be suddenly playing a game of hunt the imaginary Pokemon through the trees, you know. And actually, at the time, I remember thinking, oh, this is really frustrating. I've got a plan and my plan isn't working. And now they're the bits that I love and remember and really cherish, actually.
We're exploring wintering, what it means. And author Catherine May's new book is about when life stands still, frozen, but the world moves on. When you've wintered painful times, how do you feel like the world around you has reacted? Do you feel like you were alone when you have gone through a wintering? What does it mean to you? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Catherine May here on the Ideas Network. How do you feel about winter? Have you gone through a personal winter of sadness or hopelessness? We're exploring a new memoir about these darker moments of life, what to do with them, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. I'm dwelling on this passage from Catherine May's new book, Wintering, and she writes, doing those deeply unfashionable things, slowing down, letting your spare time expand, getting enough sleep, resting is a radical act now, but it is essential. Can you allow yourself to slow down? How do you feel about the long winter ahead? What are you letting go of? It's 800-642-1234 to talk. And author Catherine May stays with us for the hour. Catherine, you devote quite a bit of time to sleep and how it works, how you think about sleep. Can you talk to us a little bit more about why you really honed in on the power of sleep?
Yeah, and to be clear, I devote a lot of time to sleep in real life as well, not just in books. I'm a sleep fan. Like many people, when I was going through a personal winter, I experienced insomnia. And I've experienced it all through my life and often felt that I'm in inverted commas, a bad sleeper, someone that sleeps very lightly, that wakes a lot in the night and who's easily disrupted. And so in the course of my research for Wintering, I came across this this wonderful book by Roger Ekirch that talked about the idea that before the Industrial Revolution, it was normal for people, particularly in the long winter nights, to undertake a first and second sleep with a break in the middle when you woke up that was called the watch. And that's because, when you think about it, it's probably obvious that if there's no unnatural light coming in, if we can't put a lamp on when the sun goes down, there's just this long period of time to fill in the night, and people would have naturally fallen asleep earlier. All of those cues that come when the darkness comes will have made them sleepy earlier than we do, because they weren't looking at their mobile phone at 11 o'clock at night. not naming any names or looking at anyone here, but we all know how many of us do it. And so they'd have gone to sleep maybe 8:30 or 9 o'clock, slept for 4 or 5 hours, and then very naturally woken up. And they'd have been awake for about 2 hours then, maybe three, chatting to their family. There was no one else around, so actually it was a very intimate, quiet time. They'd have prayed, they'd have meditated, they'd have read if they had enough candlelight. People often didn't have enough candlelight. And it was a time that people really valued as a very kind of particular moment in the day. And after they'd been up for a couple of hours, they'd have gone back to sleep again and then woken up with the natural sunlight coming in the morning. And I learned to adopt this. So I went from waking in the night and kind of panicking and grinding over all my problems and not only worrying about my life, but also worrying that I wasn't sleeping. And I think we all know that loop that we get into, that huge frustration with yourself that you just cannot get back to sleep. And so I started experimenting with simply getting up, keeping the lights low in the house, not turning on any screens at all, but doing gentle activities like reading and writing in my notebook and meditating. And weirdly, as soon as I started getting up and acting on that being awake, I wasn't awake for any longer than I would have been if I just laid in bed and waited it out anyway. But I created this really beautiful space for myself in the middle of the night that I'm a bit disappointed if I don't wake up in the night now. I love that time.
It's like this just really peaceful pause. It's a quiet pause.
It's beautiful. I get very little time to myself, as do loads of mothers. And this is, this feels like my time. I light candles, I cozy up. I sometimes even light the fire if I'm feeling really cheeky. But really interestingly, there's some scientific research that's been done on this now, which showed that if you take anybody back to the natural light patterns of winter that we would have had even 100 years ago and not thought anything of them, they fall very naturally into this very distinct pattern of sleeping. And if you test their blood during that time in the middle of the night, what you find is a kind of hormonal profile that you don't see at any other point. And in particular, people's blood becomes very high in levels of prolactin, which is the hormone that's normally associated with breastfeeding mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings about a kind of calm, serene, meditative, dreamy state. And so actually, this is, it seems to me that this is a period of the night that we were meant to know, and a state of mind that we're really missing out on because we're trying to regiment sleep for the post-industrial world, and it's not really working that well for us.
So when you wake in the middle of the night, embrace it in a way and let it be, let it come. Because I'm sure that after you have that peaceful pause, that you're probably able to fall asleep quite well, quite easily after it.
Absolutely. I mean, I now just stay awake until I feel sleepy again, and I trust myself to know when I'm tired. I learned that skill when I was a child, hopefully. And in the meantime, I'm enriching myself with all kinds of things that I wouldn't have time to do in the day.
We're talking with Catherine May, who's the author of Wintering: The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. And we're learning about patterns of life, patterns of sleep, and this idea of wintering and where we see it in our own lives. You can join into the conversation, 800-642-1234. Catherine, I want to jump from this really solitary moment in sleep and wakefulness to this notion of pagan ceremonies and festivals, which is, a really uplifting and really interesting piece as well. What did you see in the focus on pagan ceremonies and festivals? What drew you to these people events?
Well, I grew up without much access to anything like that, not just in a pagan sense, but without any religious or spiritual beliefs. And part of my research, I suppose, drew me towards the moments that people gather in winter. What becomes really clear, I think, is that winter in particular attracts festivals. It attracts festivals of light like Diwali and Christmas. But it also attracts gatherings. It would have been much more difficult for us to gather in the past, and so people did it very deliberately. So I wanted to try some out. So, I mean, I didn't just go to pagan ones. I also went to the Santa Lucia service, the annual Swedish Santa Lucia service, where the famous one where the girls walk down the aisle with burning candles in a crown around their head. But shortly after that, I attended the annual winter solstice celebrations at Stonehenge. And I mean, partly, you know what? I just wanted to see what it was like,
This
I
is
wanted
book
to
research
understand.
after all.
Exactly. I mean, this is the great privilege of being an author. You can ring them up and go, "Can I come?" And they were like, "You don't have to ask, anyone can come. You know, that it's not this is not a kind of closed event. So as long as you're willing to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get to Stonehenge in the dark in the middle of the winter, go for your life, you know. But it's the only time in the year when they take the barrier down. So they do it at the summer solstice as well. So there's 2 points in the year when they take the fence down that's always around the Stonehenge. And you know, a big part of me just wanted to get up close to it and see what it was like. Because my dad always used to say when he was a kid there was no fence, you know. And I thought, well, I'm finally going to be able to do this. So we went along really not knowing what to expect. I went with my friend who's actually a Stone Age archaeologist, so she had quite a lot of understanding of what was going on. And with our children too, although they didn't like being pulled out of bed too much. And took part in this very what I describe as a very diverse worship, really. There were loads of different people there, and very few of them were all doing the same thing. It was this gathering of people who, for whatever reason, wanted to mark the turning of the year. And it was beautiful, and it was crazy too. You know, there were kind of drums drumming and people dancing and smoke coming from somewhere and singing and somebody dressed as a spaceman. You know, there was all kinds of things going on. But actually, it was very tolerant and very friendly and very happy. And as the sun began to rise, everybody massed in the middle of the stones and began to sing and drum. And there was this sense of kind of ecstasy rising up. And you got a sense of what it must have been like in our ancestral past when this was a site of worship as well. Well, we think it was, we don't know, but that's our best guess at it. And so the sun rising after the shortest day comes up through the stones, and it was something very, very special in a way that you couldn't pin down. There was no fixed belief behind it, but it was beautiful anyway.
And you're thinking to yourself, I have to put this in words. I have to put this ultra sensory experience in words. How do I do this?
That, do you know what? That was the, it's funny that you picked up on that, because that was the bit that I thought the most. How on earth do I capture this moment? Because it's so particular. But I mean, I suppose it's quite funny that in the end, the sun, it was so overcast that we didn't actually see the sunrise. It just got lighter. And after a while, everyone was like, oh, I think it's morning. And then sort of dispersed.
But isn't that how life goes, right?
Yeah, that's so British.
Catherine May's memoir is Wintering. And her new book, we're looking at how to prepare to settle into the winter, what we see out of wintering in our own lives. You can join in 800-642-1234. We will be back with Catherine May right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. As we head into our cold winter months, we're contemplating our lives, when we felt low, when we felt run down, devastated, out of gas. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Catherine May's new book is called Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. And she writes, wintering is the act of acceptance of sadness. It's the practice of allowing ourselves to feel it as a need. It is the courage to stare down the worst parts of our experience and to commit to healing them the best we can. What is your advice for going through a difficult time? When you've wintered painful times, how did you feel? Like the world around you reacted? 800-642-1234 to join in. And Catherine May is with us for the hour. Let's bring in Frank now in La Crosse. Hi, Frank. What would you like to say?
Well, I thought everyone would like to share my memories as a child about 50 to 60 years ago growing up in Monona. Madison, of course, has four lakes, and the change in Lake Monona over wintertime brought some significant memories. I lived about two blocks from the lake and would go down to play often, including in the wintertime. And there were three conditions of the ice changing over winter that really stuck with me. One was a sheet of clear ice you could skate on that went all the way across the lake. And as that got colder, you could hear the creaking, moaning, shrieking of the ice as it compacted itself. So that image, both visually and orally, was quite significant. The other change was when the wind would start to break up the sheet ice, and it would pile the sheet upon itself in teepees or tents 6 to 20 feet tall. And as a little child, that was quite impressive to crawl amongst that. And lastly, when the ice totally broke up as spring approached, and you could walk out 100, 200 feet on the sheet of ice to the open water. And looking back, I thought, what a risky venture that would have been if I had fallen in that cold water. So just those memories. And of course, as a child, I read all about the Arctic and Antarctic explorations in the wintertime. So I suppose I matched myself as an explorer.
Oh, Frank, what a brilliant memory. And certainly the passage of winter. Catherine, what can you share on Frank's observations as a child?
Oh, Frank, I just love that so much. I can't tell you. I actually got my notebook and was writing it down as you spoke. And I think what that shows us is that there was a time very recently when we were intimate with winter, when we really were able to read its progress and to understand. And like the way you described that with all of your senses, you know, this wasn't just about how the ice looked, but it had different textures, it had different sounds at different moments, and you knew how to read it. And I love this image of you walking across the sheet ice over to the open water. And I agree, it sounds hugely dangerous, but I think also you had experience of it. You knew what you could trust, and clearly you were okay in the end. So thank goodness for that. But isn't that just wonderful? I wish that all of our children now had that same contact with the rhythms of the world and of winter.
I think Frank gives us a really good opening to talk about you swimming in the ocean in the winter.
Well, it sounds like he nearly swam accidentally. Yes, I do. Yeah. Is that a common? I went to. Sorry, I know you're the one asking the questions, but is that a common thing
Well, we
around where
do,
you live?
yeah, we do these polar plunges, and they're usually like a fundraiser. So people jump into this open area of the lake, and then they fish them right back out. You get right back out, but you raise money for the polar plunge, and it goes toward a cause. So there is some tradition in that, across the pond, if you will.
Okay. Okay, yeah. So we used to do that in Whitstable. We used to get in for New Year once a year, and we'd all stand in a big group on the shore and run in screaming and run out again screaming, and it was pretty quick, So while I was writing the book, I got invited by a group of people locally to join them. They'd all decided to form a group that was called Sea Swimming All Year Round. And they had decided that they were going to start mid-February. And I said, yes, please, absolutely. And then turned up on the day, and it was only me and one other person who had been brave enough to show. But we got in. I was wearing a wetsuit that I'd bought in a thrift store that didn't really fit me very well. It was a bit baggy, and there's no point in a baggy wetsuit. But we decided to give it a go. And I think the sea would have been about 3 or 4 degrees centigrade on that day, so just literally just above zero. And that first time I got in, I thought, because it's very different to running in with a load of other people, it took so much bravery. And I felt like my whole body had seized up and that I was never going to be able to breathe again. And I think I probably stayed in for less than a minute and then came running out again. But standing on the beach afterwards, I was struck by this absolute joy at what I'd just done. And I immediately wanted to do it again. So I swam every day of the week after that. And by the middle of the week, I'd dispensed with the wetsuit because there was just no point in it anyway. But I knew I could get by without it. And by the end of the week, I could stay in for 10 minutes at a time. So I acclimatized surprisingly quickly and just learned to love what it gave me.
What did it give you?
So cold water swimming gives you an incredible high that's very, very unexpected. First of all, when you get in, you carry on feeling like it's freezing cold and awful. That never goes away. But if you can last out the first minute, you start being able to breathe again, which I find always helps for keeping alive and stuff like that. And then and then you get hit by this sense of serenity and calm that just is so immediate and so wonderful. And that's partly because you're in this beautiful environment, with the soundscape is so beautiful when you're swimming. The water is different every time. There's always something to observe. The birds fly over you. It's absolutely lovely. But then it's not just that. There's a sense of euphoria that comes too. And we always swim in a group for safety. We never swim alone. And we chatter. We can't stop. As soon as we get in, we're like chat, 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 giggling, screaming. And also pouring out everything that's on our mind. Like it seems to be a shortcut to intimacy. It seems to short circuit something in us that means that we share stuff that perhaps we wouldn't otherwise. We don't necessarily know each other that well outside of the swimming, but we also know a lot about each other. It's such a relief. It takes the weight off. But again, it changes your kind of the profile of your blood work. So it acts very much like the drug ecstasy. There's a huge serotonin release that happens, and there's so much joy that comes from it. I love it. I wouldn't be without it now.
You talked with a woman in Denmark, actually, who's a member of a polar bear club there, goes swimming in the freezing cold water like you, and that's really helped her deal with her bipolar disorder.
Yeah, fascinating daughter who is a molecular biologist, actually. So she knows a lot about this stuff. And she turned to cold water swimming when she'd got to a point when her doctors had told her that there was no more they could do in terms of a medication regime to help her, that she was just going to have to be effectively very disabled by her bipolar disorder for the rest of her life. And interestingly for her, instead of that making her lose hope, it gave her a kind of hope. It gave her this sense that she had to find the best way to live as she was, rather than to keep hoping to one day be totally like normal, you know, and I'm using my air quotes there, which of course you can't see. And so she started, first of all, she started getting in a cold water plunge pool at a local spa, and then she started sea swimming. And it gave her such enormous relief from her symptoms that after a couple of years, she actually ended up coming off of her medication under the close supervision of her doctor. But she was really careful to tell me that, yes, she thinks the cold water really helped, but that more than anything, it was part of taking care of herself. And she started taking care of her own needs for the first time in her life. Mm. So she was making time to rest and to do something pleasurable. And she also began to eat better. She began to get more sleep. She began to stop chasing around, trying to look after all the other people around her, which is, I think, something that so many of us do. You know, she was always looking after someone else's kids or running on an errand for someone and just trying to be helpful. And it was more than she could take. And so swimming for her kind of triggered off this whole regime of self-care that made her life much, much easier to deal with. And she's been symptom free for a number of years now. She says that, you know, she's always aware that it could all come to her again, but she's got a way of managing it. And the best image that she gave me is, because I said, well, what do you do in the summer? And she said, oh, that's no problem. I've got a big tub in my back garden that holds a cubic ton of ice. And in the midsummer, I drive down to the local harbour with a trailer where they, you know, where they're processing all the fish, and I buy this kind of cubic ton of ice from them, fill up my bath with some water, and I sit in it for half an hour.
she's committed.
She is devoted to it. But like something I don't do is I don't put my head under when I'm swimming because I don't like walking home with wet hair. But she is a big believer in getting your head under. And there is some research that actually that is hugely beneficial because it kind of soothes the vagus nerve that runs from our brain right down our body. So that's something that I need to bring into my cold water practice next. I'm not looking forward to that bit.
Yeah, I'm wondering how long your cold water practice stays with you for the rest of the day. Like it's this envelops you for a while because your body has to come back to equilibrium.
It does. You get this feeling, I always say it feels sparkly in my veins. You know, you get this feeling that your blood has been chilled down a bit and it feels cold running through you in a really delightful kind of tingly way. And that can last for a couple of hours, but it often makes me like a tired in a cozy, soothed way, you know, like a kind of almost childish way. And that can easily last the rest of the afternoon. So it has a huge effect, actually. And it definitely just shifts my mood and makes me happier for the rest of the day.
Author Catherine May's new memoir is called Wintering: The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. She writes about how, in her words here, we can fall through the mesh of the everyday world. How do you feel when something happens out of the blue? Have you coped with depression or an ongoing mental health issue? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with author Catherine May. Her new memoir is called Wintering, and it explores that human journey through our personal winters. And she writes, I recognized winter. I greeted it and let it in. Nature shows that survival is a practice. Are you wintering, regrouping and healing to get through tough times? Join in, still time to talk, 800-642-1234. And Catherine May stays with us for 10 more minutes. Catherine, you have autism, which went undiagnosed when you were a child. And you say that you spent your childhood permanently out in the cold. And when you were a teenager, you had severe depression. How has your mental health shaped your connection to the notion of wintering?
Yeah, well, I think it's made me a kind of expert in it. I mean, growing up autistic, I regularly crashed out of everyday life. I got to the point where I couldn't cope anymore quite often, because actually it's very exhausting doing what loads of other girls do when they're growing up if they're autistic, which is to mask it very carefully. Boys mask too, but it seems to be much more common that girls are able to conceal themselves being autistic in a way that lets them pass in everyday life, but which at the same time is actually really toxic for them because it leads to us burning out very regularly. And that meant that I had periods of depression from very young, and also periods of kind of unexplained illness when I couldn't go to school because I was just very, very tired and full of aches and pains and things like that, you know, and feeling very rejected by the medical establishment who couldn't really make an account of me and what was going on. So with that pattern established in my life, that didn't get broken until I finally got my diagnosis when I was approaching 40.
Wow.
Which meant that it's a very, very long time to live with feeling different to everybody else in a way that you can't quite put your finger on, but you know that you're different. You know that you're not experiencing the world in the same way. You know that you are not wanting the same things from life as other people. And I always felt like I had to become a better person. I had to improve myself somehow, that I had to find the therapy or the technique or the, you know, or the practice that would finally fix me and make it okay. And that doesn't exist for me. I mean, I say I'm autistic rather than have autism. And that's a very important distinction for me,
mm-hmm.
because actually it's a fundamental part of who I am. It's a fundamental part of my basic makeup and how my brain works. I don't believe that can be cured, and I don't want it to be cured, because what I needed to learn was how to live as I need to live. And it's amazing. I mean, you see this pattern over and over again of people who are late diagnosed like I am, that once we know what we are and what we're dealing with and stop trying to fake all the stuff that we're trying to fake and stop trying to push ourselves into situations that we can't cope with, that completely overwhelm our nervous system, we find this incredible kind of comfort and joy in being able to be who we are. And I've made some, really basic adaptations to my life that make me much happier and much more able to endure the sort of stresses and strains of being me. But that means that I have this backup of winters that I've been through, and this enormous compassion for other people going through them, because I just know how bitter and how hard they are.
Yeah, I wonder if that late diagnosis and when it came, whether it was an aha moment or whether it was like, oh, I knew this all along, this was here, and now it's just being validated.
Can I say both of those things at the same time? Because actually that's kind of how it felt. Like it as soon as I realized, because I mean, one of the problems for people like me is there's not many representations of us in mainstream discourse. So I never had the chance to hear an autistic woman talking about what it was like to be autistic for her before. And the moment I did, you know, this is the power of radio, right? I was listening to a woman being interviewed.
Mm.
The moment I heard her describe her experience, it just downloaded into me. It suddenly all made sense to me. And then everything I read about it, I knew that I recognized myself. So it felt like a big aha, but it also felt like coming home. And when I finally got the courage to tell my husband, I was so worried about what he'd think. And I was worried he'd think I'd completely lost it and that I was, you know, grasping at straws. And he said, oh, yeah, of course you are. And so many other members of my family and close friends did it as well. They all recognized it immediately. I mean, I really hope that this generation of girls won't have to go through that long process of coming home like I did.
And they didn't see you any differently, that they still were the exact same person you knew, the exact same spouse you know?
Yes, actually. I mean, I think one of the privileges of being autistic is that the people who love you really, really love you. You know, we maybe have fewer friends than other people generally because we can't fit into like neurotypical conventions of social life. But the people who we are close to are friends for life. Like, we are incredibly loyal, I think, and make very devoted friends, and we attract very devoted friends too. And actually, I found more acceptance than I've ever had before. And sometimes from people that I didn't expect it from, who may be related themselves and who, you know, told me about patterns of my behavior that they had observed that I wasn't even aware of. Like one of my like fairly good friends that I didn't know that well said, "Now I know why you've disappeared at every party." And I was like, "Have I?" And then I stopped to think about it. Yes, I did. I used to convince myself that I was enjoying myself, but I would always end up shutting myself in the toilet or hiding under piles of coats in the spare bedroom, you know, when people have piled them up, or getting myself right to the bottom of the garden where it was dark and I could be on my own. And I suddenly looked back over my life and saw this pattern of escaping that I hadn't noticed, but that people around me had, you know. And she said, "I always wondered what was going on with you." And I said, "I had no idea something was going on. I thought I was enjoying myself." I just don't go to so many parties anymore, and that's always a lot of problems for me.
We're talking with Catherine May, who is the author of Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Let's take another call now. William is with us from Upper Michigan this morning. Hi, William.
Oh, hello, ladies. Thank you for what you do, both of you. And a great topic. Yeah, I've used cold therapy for some pain factors with leg issues, and I found it very remarkable. And you reach a state of kind of nirvana or bliss. And a gentleman that I follow was a Wim Hof. He, they call him the Iceman. I climbed Everest in his shorts and boots and a hat.
Mm. Oh, my goodness. Can I ask how
I
you're
a publisher with him in the UK?
William, how are you doing now?
It's better. It's a pretty good pain reliever. You have to build your tolerance up and chop the ice actually already now, but you find it kind of very comforting the first little bit as a shocker, but as you build up to, you know, a minute and 2 minutes and then reach like three and above, you kind of reach a different state. In relief.
Yeah. William, thank you for sharing that. You know, Catherine, we're about out of time in a minute or so, but I want to ask
I've had
you.
Oh, so much fun.
Oh, me too. Me too. You know, pain, it can also bring so much wisdom. And I'm wondering what you can leave us with there as we all go through our own winters. What can this pain give us on the other side?
Yeah, physical and emotional pain. I mean, none of it is enjoyable. And I don't ever want to be the person that says, "Oh, don't worry, this is all great. This is all enriching you." Like, no, we're allowed to say that this is awful. But that doesn't mean to say that we are not learning something through that awfulness. You know, this brings us into closer contact with our humanity, with what we are. We learn wisdom, we learn coping skills. And you know what? Most of all, we learn compassion and empathy for the other people around us. Because when you start to look around, everybody's suffering in one way or another. And this life trains us to do better for our communities as well as for ourselves. And I think that, for me, is the real value of wintering.
Oh, Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely.
Catherine May is the author of Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Just ahead, it is 1A, the first signs of a post-Thanksgiving surge start to show up. The FDA makes its move on Pfizer's COVID vaccine. Jen White will have all of the week's biggest stories on the Friday News Roundup. That is next on 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Laura Pavin, Jana Rose Schleiss, Courtney Everett, Keegan Kyle, L. Malik Anderson, Stephen Potter, and Joe Tarr. Lee Rayburn is our technical director, and Molly Stentz is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.